Excuse me, 9:12, thank you. Present, we have myself, co-chair Green. We have representatives of Ogun and Cott. And on teleconference, we have, supposedly, if he's on yet, we have several on-site locations. We have co-chair Williams in Ketchikan and Osterman in Kodiak. We have a representative. We also have Fairbanks and Kotzebue on teleconference. I see no other representatives present. We have today just one agenda item, which is House Bill 341, a tax court bill. A few years ago, under the previous administration, the legislature was called back into special session to consider a bill that dealt with taxes, specifically taxes to the oil industry, and I'm referring to Senate Bill 377. And as part of the hearing process on that legislation, we received quite an education on taxes, including how they are paid and what happens if they were contested. I came out of that whole experience with a belief that the state of Alaska does not treat its taxpayers fairly, nor does, and it's not because of what we ask them to pay, but rather that because the system seems divergent in view, and when assessed and contested, the state assumes, and this I think is the problem, the role of the prosecutor, the judge, and the expediter. One agency assesses the tax, and then, if appealed, the process requires that that same agency decide the assessment is fair or unfair. And then finally, if the taxpayer continues to appeal the assessment through the administration onto the court, the judge in the court then decides the case based on a brief written by the original agency. I don't believe that system or the process it mandates provides a fair, at arm's length review. So earlier this year, I introduced House Bill 341 as an option to the present system. I stress the word option. I happen to like the way it's written, but I want you to know that that is just a model. It's just an attempt to correct the situation. I think the fact that it would be at a superior court level would make it a workable situation. And while anybody in the audience or on teleconference that has other ideas, I would welcome those. I hope that while we may have different views as to what is the best fix for this broken thing, I want to end up, ultimately, I hope, with something that's workable, that is fair, and if not more precise, at least it's something that both the state and the industry can gain from. And we have members of the public who have expressed their desire to testify, and to them I would like to say only that there is no politically correct position to take, and that while I would welcome your ideas, I think we need to remember that we're actually making comments about the system and not individuals, and that I think that our people in the various agencies of state government, most of whom I think truly, really try to do the best thing they can for the state. And so I would hope that there wouldn't be any chastisement of either the agencies or the individuals, since they're only doing what they're told to do by law. And so that's the purpose of this meeting, is to make the law that they would then interpret and operate under a much more effective law. And so with that, I'm going to turn the meeting over to my senior staffer, Jeff Logan, who will introduce the bill. Unless there are any original opening questions anyone would like to ask, we'll proceed along that line and then take testimony from those who wish to testify. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. My name is Jeff Logan. My purpose here, Mr. Chairman, is to simply introduce the bill to the committee by going through the bill section by section and giving a...
Excuse me, Jeff. Can everybody hear him?
my purpose here is...
Jeff, you might want to swing around so that you can, if you wouldn't mind, I appreciate that.
My purpose here, Mr. Chairman, is to go through the bill section by section and give a superficial description to the committee so they know exactly what's in it. Starting out with Section 1 on page 1 simply establishes the tax court as a one-judge trial court. Section 2212.020, beginning on line 11 of page 1, allows the court, the tax court, to hear all cases involving, and the statute references are listed at the top of page 2, 4319, the Multi-State Tax Compact, 4320, the Alaska Net Income Tax Act, 4321, the Oil and Gas Corporate Income Tax, 4355, the Oil and Gas Production Tax, 4365, the Mining License Tax, 4375, the Fisheries Tax. Sub 2 there allows claims resulting from all of the above laws to be heard in the Small Claims Division established further in the bill. And sub 3 allows the court to decide whether a proposed tax regulation is valid and gives the tax court the same powers as that of the Superior Court in these matters. 2212.030 establishes that the venue where the cases will be heard will be set by the Supreme Court. 040 sets out the reasons why the venue can be changed. 050 establishes when the tax court will be open for business. And 060 states that the court can adjourn itself and call itself back into session, and that adjournment does not prevent the court from sitting at any time. 070 establishes how official court documents will be processed. 080 establishes the qualifications for tax court judges and prohibits a person who has, in the past 4 years, been employed by the departments of law or revenue from serving as a tax court judge. 090 directs the governor to fill a vacancy on the court within 45 days of receiving nominations from the Judicial Council. Sub B establishes that a vacancy occurs upon death or resignation or 90 days after an election if the judge is not retained by the voters. 100 requires the tax court judge to take the oath of office. 110 states the tax court judge is subject to approval or rejection by the voters, and that the Judicial Council must conduct an evaluation of the judge before the election and make the results of that evaluation public. 120 allows the tax court judge to be impeached by the legislature for malfeasance or misfeasance and sets out how that impeachment will be conducted. 130 restricts the tax court judge from practicing law or engaging in any activity for compensation if that conduct would interfere with his or her judicial duties. Sub B disqualifies the judge from the bench if they file for public office except as a delegate for a constitutional convention. The bottom of page 5, 2212.140 establishes the same salary for the tax court judge as for the Superior Court, which is a range 28 step E, monthly salary of $7,667. Sub B requires the judge to certify that they don't have decisions more than 6 months outstanding before they are paid. The court system already imposes this rule on itself. Sub C allows for geographic cost of living adjustments. 200, starting with Article 2, the top of page 6, provides that the Supreme Court may adopt rules for taking an appeal to the tax court. If the court does not do that, then the current appellate rules apply. 210 establishes that taxpayers will be given a new trial, de novo trial, in tax court. Subsection B states that only those issues raised in the Department of Revenue administrative proceedings can be raised in court. However, if the court determines that other matters are important to the case, it can be remanded back to the department. 220, at the bottom of page 6, establishes the burden of proof to be the preponderance of the evidence, which is the usual civil trial burden of proof. 230 establishes, we're at the top of page 7 now, 230 establishes hearings before the tax court as public hearings and allows for confidential information to be protected.
240 requires the tax court to issue decisions in writing. 250 allows the court to appoint a panel of masters, three individuals, to collect and analyze technical information and prepare decisions subject to the judge's adoption. 260 allows the court to publish tax court decisions. And 2212-300 establishes a small claims division within the tax court. 310 sets $15,000 as the threshold under which a small claim may be filed. 320 establishes the procedure for filing a small claim. 330 on page 9 requires the clerk of the tax court to notify the Department of Revenue when a small claim has been filed. 340 allows the taxpayer to dismiss a small claims case anytime before a judgment is entered, and the dismissal is with prejudice, meaning it cannot be brought up again. 350 at the bottom of page 9 establishes that small claims hearings are informal hearings. Court may hear testimony and receive evidence, and the party may appear before the court or be represented. 360 at the top of page 10 states that a small claim judgment is conclusive but is not a judicial precedent for the purposes of other judicial matters. Section 2, middle top part of page 10, which is AS 1515030 sub 10, prescribes the ballot for the retention election of a tax court judge. Section 3 states that the tax court judge will stand for retention at the first general election after his or her third year in office. If approved by the voters, the judge will stand before the voters every sixth year thereafter. 094 prescribes that the tax court judge shall file a declaration of candidacy by August 1st of the year of the general election. 096 is a $30 filing fee. 098 directs the Director of Elections to place the name of a properly qualified tax court judge on the ballot for election. Section 4, page 11, line 9, states that the Judicial Council shall file with the Lieutenant Governor's office by August 7th of the year in which the general election will be held, a statement including information on the tax court judge. Section 5 establishes a $150 fee for the tax court candidates to pay if they want to put something about themselves in the voter's pamphlet. Section 6 adds the tax court to the list of courts to which an appeal as a matter of right may be taken. Section 7, at the top of page 12, grants the right of appeal, or the right to appeal, rather, a Department of Revenue decision to the tax court. Section 8 states that if a tax court judge is not retained by the voters, he or she cannot be appointed to fill a judicial vacancy for 4 years thereafter. Section 9 is doing the same thing. Section 10 grants to the tax court from the Superior Court jurisdiction in all tax matters appealed from the Department of Revenue. Section 11 is the same as Sections 8 and 9. Sections 12 is the same as Sections 11. Those all refer to judicial vacancies. Section 13 adds a judge of the tax court to the definition of judicial officer. These definitions are used in the statutes that address disqualification of judicial officers for cause, which is AS 2220020, and the power of judicial officers, which is AS 2220030. Section 14 allows the Chief Justice to reassign a case if a party or a party's attorney feel they cannot get a fair trial. This is the peremptory challenge. Section 15 exempts from small claims proceedings the requirement that the U.S. government and corporations be represented by attorneys. Section 16 states that the Commissioner of Public Safety shall serve all process issued by the tax court as it does with the other courts currently. Section 17 adds tax court judge in the definition of judge for the purposes of the judicial retirement system and of the standards of judicial conduct. Section 18 is same as Section 17. Section 19 sets out the procedure to appeal a tax decision by the Department of Revenue and what action the court shall take upon reaching a decision. Section 20 establishes the threshold for or defines a final decision by DOR for the purposes of an appeal to the tax court. Section 20, we're near the top of page 16 now, establishes the threshold for or defines a final decision by DOR for the purposes of an appeal to the tax court. 21 requires a taxpayer who appeals a revenue ruling to pay the undisputed portion of the levy plus any penalty or interest, and then to provide satisfactory evidence to the court that the taxpayer is able to pay the balance. 43.05.244 allows the taxpayer or the Department of Revenue to credit any overpayment made by the taxpayer against the taxpayer's tax liability for the current or subsequent years. Any amount not refunded within 3 years shall be paid to the taxpayer with interest. Section 22 allows an interested person to get an opinion from the tax court as to the validity of a tax regulation. Section 23, near the middle of page 17, is the transition section. Sets out that a revenue ruling appeal to the Superior Court shall be heard by the tax court if the appeal has not yet been filed with the Supreme Court. Sub B allows the tax court to hear new evidence that was not presented during the revenue administrative hearing. Sub C allows a party whose case has been referred to the tax court to request that the case be heard by a panel of masters. The last section, the bottom of page 17, section 24, is the enactment clause. And that, Mr. Chairman, in all its glory, 17 pages of House Bill 341.
Thank you, Jeff. Obviously, the majority of what is included in the bill is a reiteration of existing law. It's just those portions that have changed, but I'm glad you did carry us through that. Are there any questions of Jeff before we get into the other testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, you're right that about 15 of the 17 pages are what we call boilerplate. But there have been some questions from the committee, so just to make sure everyone is on the same footing, sorry to take so much time.
Yeah, it's quite all right. I appreciate that, as well as I'm sure the audience did.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Osterman.
Oh, thank you. Representative Osterman is online. Representative Williams, are you online?
This is Pete Eklund. Representative Williams isn't here yet.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Chairman, I have a question for you, Mike.
Yes, Representative Osterman.
Just to help me understand a little bit, when they appeal a decision of the Department of Revenue under this bill, does that appeal go to the Superior Court first, or does it go straight to the tax court?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Osterman, this is Jeff Logan again. That appeal would go directly to the newly created tax court.
I thank you.
One of the reasons for that is there's an awful lot of time used in the current process of stepwise procedure when it, in most cases, if it's worthy of an argument, it's probably going to end up in tax court anyway. And this is a way to circumvent some of the lost time. 6 months or more is often required to work its way through the process. Any other questions from any teleconference site? If not, we have several people who wish to testify this morning. I'll take them in the following order. We have Steve Mahoney representing the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. If you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and present your testimony.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Resources Committee. My name is Steve Mahoney. As the authorized representative of the Tax Committee of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, I'm here today to testify on behalf of AOGA regarding House Bill 341, which it proposes to establish a special tax court at the Superior Court level within the Alaska court system. AOGA is a trade organization whose 18-member companies account for the majority of oil and gas exploration, production, transportation, refining, and marketing activities in Alaska. We are grateful for this opportunity to offer our comments. HB 341 presents some very critical issues. To summarize, AOGA believes strongly that the present system of tax audits and appeals is flawed in two major ways, which I will describe in a moment. AOGA is not prepared at this time to take a position on this bill, nor to recommend specific amendments. But we do support reform, and we will continue to work on a definitive solution, and would like to set the stage with the following background. The two major flaws in the present system are, first, that it does not allow for tax appeals to be decided by a truly impartial decision maker, and second, that the burden of proof is not fairly allocated between the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue. In order to explain to the committee exactly what these problems are and why they are problems, let me begin with a brief review of how the present system works in terms of who does what and when. As I do so, I would invite you to follow along by looking at the diagram illustrating the process. Excuse me for not having those hands out.
Yeah, Representative Logan.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to interrupt. What are the? I caught the first flaw. I can't write that fast. Could you give me the? Doesn't allow the appeals to be impartial. What was the other?
The second is that the burden of proof we don't believe is fairly allocated between the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue.
Thank you.
The diagram appears on the last page of the written testimony that I've provided. What I'm going to do is start at the top of the diagram and work my way down through the items in bold print. The chairman eloquently discussed this earlier, and I hate to be repetitive, but I'm going to try to do it on a detailed step-by-step basis as we see it. The process begins when the taxpayer files a tax return and pays the taxes due according to that return. This means, in the case of production taxes, that we will file a tax return at the end of next month of the oil and gas we produce this month. For the corporate state income tax, which is reported on an annual basis, we file our tax return for a given year in mid-October of the following year. In other words, we will file our income tax return for 1995 in October of 1996. The filing of the tax return starts the clock running for the Department of Revenue to audit the return. The statute of limitations gives DOR 3 years from the filing of the return in which to complete the audit and make claims for additional tax, if any, which the auditor contends is owed. This 3-year period may be extended by mutual agreement of the DOR and the taxpayer for however long and as many times as they may deem necessary. For oil and gas taxpayers, DOR ordinarily audits 2 or 3 years worth of tax returns at a time. Usually, the audit is completed within 3 years from the filing of the earliest of the returns being audited, and DOR asks the taxpayer usually the audit is not completed within 3 years from the filing of the earliest returns audited, and the DOR asks the taxpayer for 1 or more extensions for each audit. We taxpayers have cooperated by agreeing to at least 1 extension and usually several. Upon the completion of DOR's initial audit, the auditors almost always send a bill for more tax to the taxpayer. The technical name for such a bill is an assessment. Very often the assessment or tax bill is issued to the taxpayer just before the extended limitations period expires. When a taxpayer receives a bill for more tax, it can choose to do 1 of 3 things. It can pay the bill, it can file an appeal of part or all of the bill and ask for an informal conference with DOR, or it can file an appeal of part or all of the bill and ask for a formal hearing before a DOR hearing officer. The taxpayer must make its choice within 60 days of receiving the bill for more tax. Within this same 60-day period, the taxpayer must pay any undisputed portion of the bill. If the taxpayer pays the bill, the DOR auditors cannot make any further claims for more tax after the expiration of the statute of limitations. Since the statute is so often on the verge of expiring when the tax bill is issued, choosing to pay the bill without contesting it effectively means that no further claims for additional taxes will be made for the tax periods covered by the bill. On the other hand, if the taxpayer appeals part or all of the assessment, then DOR continues to issue new claims for additional taxes at any time before the appeal gets into court. The original idea of the informal conference was to allow a taxpayer the opportunity to sit down with the DOR auditors and their supervisors and informally discuss those matters which the taxpayer believes are due to simple mistakes or misunderstandings. This option particularly makes sense when both sides are cooperating in good faith because it allows obvious or simple errors to be corrected without getting into much more expensive procedures of the formal hearing. The informal conference is conducted by a conference officer, who is usually a DOR employee in the classified service. That is, he or she has civil service protection as well as union protection and is not accountable in terms of getting fired for lapses of errors in judgment. After the informal conference with the taxpayer, the conference officer issues a written conference decision, making any corrections which he or she deems warranted in light of the information presented during the conference. There is no time limit on DOR either for holding an informal conference after one is requested, nor for issuing a conference decision after the conference is held. If the taxpayer disagrees with part or all of the informal conference decision, it may appeal the disputed portion or portions and must pay any undisputed portion of the additional taxes which the conference officer finds to be owed. The taxpayer has 30 days from the time of the conference decision in which to file its appeal and request a formal hearing. Or, as noted earlier, a taxpayer may go directly to formal hearing and bypass the informal conference as its third option when a tax bill is issued. And it does so by requesting the formal hearing within 60 days of getting the original tax bill. The formal hearing is held by a hearing officer who is in the partially exempt service. That is, he or she serves at the pleasure of his or her immediate supervisor and the commissioner. The procedures for a formal hearing resemble those of a trial. Both sides get to have legal discovery. That is, each side can ask the other about the evidence it has regarding the case. Both parties can also file various motions before and after the actual hearing, much as parties in court file motions before and after a trial. The actual hearing itself is transcribed or recorded, and that, as well as the testimony and evidence submitted at the hearing, plus all the briefs, etc., becomes part of the formal record of the appeal. The hearing officer acts as a judge in the sense that he or she rules on the meaning of the applicable statutes and regulations. The hearing officer acts as a jury in the sense that of deciding which version of the facts is accurate when the two sides disagree about what actually happened. After the hearing officer writes a formal hearing decision, making findings of fact as part of his or her role as a jury and making conclusions of law in the role as a judge. The hearing officer submits his or her written decision to the commissioner or the commissioner's designee, often the deputy commissioner or the chief hearing officer, for review and approval. The commissioner may direct the hearing officer to rewrite part or all of the decision, and in the past, commissioners have often done so, sometimes going as far to edit and rewrite the decision of the hearing officer. Despite the commissioner's potential involvement in drafting the hearing decision, the DOR won't disclose what that involvement actually is. This secretive nature of the process is especially troubling to taxpayers and colors perceptions about the fairness of the system. Once the hearing officer's decision meets the commissioner's approval, it is issued to the taxpayer and becomes final. As with the informal conference, there is no time limit on the department for holding a formal hearing after it has been requested, nor is there one for issuing the formal decision after the hearing is held. The taxpayer has 30 days from the issuance of the formal hearing decision in which to pay any uncontested portions of it and to appeal the rest to court. Now, this is the direct route for the tax audit and appeals process, as shown in the diagram attached to my written testimony. But is the DOR's position that the auditors may issue new claims for additional taxes at any time while the appeal over the original tax bill is still pending before the department? Each time they issue a new tax bill, the taxpayer has to start at step one of the appeals process for the new bill, no matter how far along in the process of the original tax bill may be. It is entirely possible that the same tax period will be audited and re-audited several times while the original appeal is pending. And indeed, this has often been the experience of taxpayers. So this is Alaska's present system of tax audits and appeals. While cumbersome, time-consuming, and expensive, the real problems are, as I mentioned at the onset, the lack of an impartial party to hear and decide tax disputes, and an inappropriate allocation of the burden of proof between the Department of Revenue and the taxpayer. To some extent, these two problems overlap one another. As you probably gathered from my description of the present process, the hearing officer plays a key role in that process. The formal hearing is the counterpart of the trial in an ordinary lawsuit. The hearing officer not only controls the schedule of the formal hearing, but he or she also rules on the various motions that the parties file, controls which evidence will be admitted and which excluded, and of course acts as a judge and jury in writing the hearing decision. On appeal to the courts, the hearing officer's factual findings in the hearing decision are given great deference. To overturn such a finding, the taxpayer must show that it is, in quotes, not supported by substantial evidence in light of the whole record, end quote, in the appeal. This does not mean that most of the evidence has to support the hearing officer's finding, only that there is some credible evidence, some evidence of substance, which supports them. In other words, where there is a dispute about what actually happened and both sides introduce credible but conflicting evidence about the events, the hearing officer can choose which witness or witnesses to believe, and that choice will be upheld by the courts because it is supported by substantial evidence. It is essential to due process to have an impartial person deciding which witnesses to believe, because which version of the facts is believed often determines the outcome of the case. Let me give an example that will be more familiar to most people than some arcane tax issue. Suppose there is a traffic accident at an intersection with a traffic signal. Each driver insists he had the green light, and they testify to that effect at trial. Suppose driver A also has a witness who says that even though he was 50 yards away from the corner, he saw that the light was green for A when A drove into the intersection. Suppose the driver B not only testifies that he had the green light, but he also brings in two witnesses who were standing right on the corner and agree that B had the green light. Both versions can't be accurate. So which one do you believe? Obviously, it's going to make a big difference which version you believe, since your decision will determine who wins and who loses. Now suppose you are the jury and you decide, for whatever reason, to believe A and his single witness. If the courts apply the same standard to your verdict as a jury as they do in reviewing the findings of a DOR hearing officer, they will uphold your decision because there is evidence of substance supporting it, even though B submitted more evidence by eyewitnesses who were both better located to see what happens. In other words, B had more evidence and better evidence, but the verdict against him will stand. If we take this example and apply it to a tax appeal before a DOR hearing officer, a disputed fact issue is a bit like having the question be this: did the taxpayer have a green light or did the commissioner? The commissioner is ultimately responsible by law for collecting the taxes and pressing the state's claims for any unpaid taxes, and thus he or she has an interest in upholding the claims that he or she believes have merit. But in an impartial system, it would be the hearing officer, not the commissioner, who decides who had the green light on a disputed factual issue, DOR or the taxpayer. In Alaska, however, the hearing officer is an at-will employee working for the commissioner. So there is a constant and not too subtle pressure on a hearing officer to believe DOR witnesses and disbelieve those of the taxpayers. This is not impartiality. Actually, though, the situation is even worse than that. The commissioner can participate directly in the writing of the hearing decision, even though he or she was never present at the hearing, because the hearing decision cannot become final without the commissioner's approval. This means the commissioner can instruct the hearing officer to rewrite critical parts of the decision so as to better support the auditor's tax claims, or may even write those parts for the hearing officer, as commissioners have done in the past. In other words, the person with the greatest power to determine what the outcome is in an appeal over a disputed tax claim, namely the Commissioner of Revenue, is the very person who has ultimate responsibility for making the claim in the first place. The head prosecutor is therefore able to act as judge and jury in tax appeals. Other states avoid this type of abuse in various ways. Those that use the same extremely high standard of deference to the hearing officer's findings, as Alaska does, also have hearing officers with the greatest degree of independence from their tax commissioners. Other states let the tax commissioner have more control over the hearing officers, but their courts make an independent decision about which witnesses to believe. Such independent judicial review is often thought, often through a so-called trial de novo, which is legalese for a new trial that is held by the court. Under either of these approaches, taxpayers receive the impartial trier of fact, which they are guaranteed under due process principles. Besides this issue of a lack of an impartial tax tribunal in the Alaska system, there is an unfair and inappropriate allocation of the burdens of proof between the DOR and the taxpayer. To a small degree, this has already been discussed in discussing that what the taxpayer has to show to the courts in order to overturn an adverse finding by the hearing officer. But there is another important aspect to this burden of proof issue. The longer the time that passes before a tax claim is made, the harder it is to find evidence to prove or disprove the claim. Memories of witnesses fade, documents get harder to find, and perceptions of the world can and frequently do change with hindsight. Yet the department does not have to prove its tax claims, no matter how long after the fact they are first raised. They are, in the words of AS 4305-245, presumed sufficient for all legal purposes. However, nothing prevents a taxpayer from presenting evidence or other information on an appeal under AS 4305-240 in order to rebut the presumed sufficiency of the department's claims. This statute means that the taxpayer always has the burden of presenting evidence or other information to show that the auditors are mistaken. This burden still exists even if so much time has passed that all the evidence no longer exists. This is unfair. One way to fix this would be to shift the burden of proof to DOR for unduly late claims. This would restore fairness to those situations where the passage of time is so great that there is no evidence left one way or the other regarding the claim. There is also a complementary approach for making progress in these areas. This is in providing taxpayers with greater clarity about exactly what their tax obligations are. The clearer the rules are, the more likely it is that the correct amount of tax will be paid in the first place. This means that the audit issues will be much smaller than they have been in terms of dollars at stake. Under Alaska's oil and gas tax rules in the past, enormous sums of money were riding on the outcome of the appeals for only a relative handful of taxpayers. Any tax appeal system works better when smaller amounts are riding on the outcome of the appeals, and probably even the present system would have worked better if the stakes in each oil and gas case hadn't been so high. AOGA is hopeful about making progress to improve the clarity of the tax rules. As many of you may recall from previous state studies, uncertainty in the fiscal rules is a significant disadvantage that Alaska has in the worldwide competition to attract dollars for new capital investments here. AOGA is exploring ways to improve the present system. Some of them may be through new tax regulations. Some may require legislation. Clearly, we would prefer to come back to you with a consensus about any legislation that may be needed. But until we complete our exploration of these possibilities, we are simply unable to recommend whether any changes to HB 341 are desirable, and if so, what those changes should be. We hope, Mr. Chairman, that you and the committee will understand our situation. We are grateful for the support that has been shown by the fact that HB 341 has been introduced and by the fact that this committee considers these matters important enough to take them up at this hearing. We are counting on your continued support and on the good faith of everyone interested in these issues. Working together, we can achieve a clear and efficient system of taxation that no longer works to impede and discourage investment in Alaska. And that will be in the benefit of us all, and an achievement in which we can all take pride and satisfaction. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. As most of the people in the audience are quite familiar with this problem, I wouldn't imagine there'd be too many questions of the speakers. However, those of you on teleconference may well have questions, and there are, as I mentioned, at least five people who want to talk. I don't want to discourage your questions. It may be that some of them will be answered with subsequent testimony, so I'll leave that to your discretion. I don't want to thwart, though, any specific question you may have of any of the testifiers, starting with Steve. Any questions of the audience or on teleconference? If not, we'll... Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Osterman again.
Yes, Representative.
If I understand this, and they faxed me this chart that the guy is using there, that Steve is using, and I appreciate that. Well, the system is not necessarily going to change, though, because we still have to go through this system to get it into trial or into tax court. Is that correct?
The system of informal and formal hearings would be different in relation to our ability to go into a tax court de novo, which is one of the items that I discussed in the testimony, and that is that our facts would be brought to light to an impartial hearing officer, so to speak, which would be the trial court judge, the tax court judge. So yes, they would be different.
Well, you still have to go to DNR you've got to go through an informal hearing first, or are you saying that you will not use this system, you go straight to a tax court?
Well, without commenting specifically on HB 341, there is a great strength in the system in that we have the ability to go to the department first and clear up and clean up any misunderstandings that are purely misunderstandings. That way we don't clog the upper system into the formal hearing process or into the court system with issues that could be easily resolved. I think that's a strength of the system rather than a weakness. Yes.
Okay, you'll have to excuse me because I don't totally understand all this stuff. But as far as the taxes and the hearing that you have to go through, I have not been involved in that. But if I understand correctly, in reading this thing where the taxpayer has a choice to start out with, whether he pays the bill and no appeal, or he goes to an informal conference. With HB 341, will you still use the informal conference?
It's my understanding that we'd have the option to use the informal conference. There are many issues with most taxpayers that are resolved in informal conference, and we can resolve some issues and not resolve others and go further in the proceedings if we choose. If we resolve those issues, we would pay the tax due and any interest on top of that, and then just move forward with the issues that were unresolved. That's correct.
Okay, one of the reasons I'm asking this is that during the informal conference, it shows that there's no time limit. Has that been a problem in the past?
I'm in a unique position because I'm speaking with 18 voices, and they can get mumbled. There are a number of taxpayers who will be testifying individually after the AOGA testimony, and I think that question could be answered by those taxpayers better than by myself.
Alan, unfortunately, you were not part of the legislature during the 377 review, and that ad nauseum discussed the problem with delays and defers, and we were talking of years, 17, 18, 19 years, of back taxes because of unresolved differences. But I hope that that'll come out in some subsequent testimony. Certainly hold on to that question. If it doesn't, we will address that.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ogden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mahoney, why is there almost always additional assessment when these after taxpayer pays his bill and it's audited? Is there some major ambiguity in the clarity of the tax regulations? I would assume there is. And in a follow-up to that, what is this, with all due respect to the author of this bill, who I'm sure worked very hard on it, is this trying to fix the symptom of the problem rather than addressing a lack of clear tax policy?
Well, I might start with that. No, this bill does not address trying to rewrite the Department of Revenue's regulations. I agree that because of so many times an issue coming up, there may be some need to clarify that. We, as I mentioned on 377 review, there was a plethora of statements made that if they could just get a tax code that said, this is what you made, this is what you owe, there probably wouldn't be any disputes. The problem is it's vague, and because of vagueness, then there's difference of interpretation. And with difference of interpretation, depending on, as was stated by the AOGA representative, Steve mentioned that if the value had been small, chances are the present system would work. But we're talking about humongous dollars here. And so if there's any credibility to my disputing your tax, I'm going to take it to the highest possible decision maker. It makes a lot of money difference. And so that decision maker, or that process of making the final decision, is what 341 addresses. Is this a fair review, or is it a stacked deck against those who appeal the taxes?
Conferences, as most of the members of the AOGA Tax Committee have been. There have been numerous, and remember now, the production tax is based on a monthly tax. There have been numerous months when we have not had adjustments. There have been numerous months when the adjustments were in our favor because we made a mistake. There are numerous months wherein, for 1 month, the lack of clarity in a regulation or in a statute created a situation where I owed tax, and in the next month, that same lack of clarity made it that I was due tax from the department. I don't know of many audit periods that there have not been additional assessments. Those additional assessments are due to lack of clarity. They might be due to mistakes, just simple mathematical mistakes, mistakes in interpretation or reading. And they may be due to new information being available today that was not available when the return was filed. They could be due to changes in the law. In the income tax area, the law is changing a great deal, and the federal tax law is prevalent over the state tax law, which is an add-on. There are numerous items and issues and areas that there can be disagreement on. The taxes in Alaska are self-assessed taxes. The taxpayer reads the statute and the regulations, makes a determination as to what they say, and files its taxes accordingly. Any two people reading the length of the documents that we have and the plethora of regulations that we have will likely come out with different ideas of what they say. And that's basically what occurs in most of the assessments. There have been strides recently in clarifying regulations with the department. There are ongoing discussions with the administration as we speak and over the past about the systems as they are and the regulations as they read. We're working towards clarity on those issues. But the major issue that we see is that if an auditor comes up and says, you owe more taxes, the reasons that assessment has been issued, the facts underlying why the assessment was issued and why the disagreement occurs, all the burden shifts to the taxpayer as to why that's not the case. Not some of the burden and not a substantive part of the burden, but all of the burden. And that's what this bill is trying to clarify and what we would appreciate the committee continuing to review.
If I may, to continue on that, and I certainly don't want it to take any of the wind out of the sails of DOR testimony, but in fairness to them, I think, since perhaps you weren't real familiar with this, one of the problems DOR has is you'd say, why not just make it a simple one-page document and everybody can read it and know exactly what the taxes are? In its simplest form, if we load up a boat full of oil in Valdez to Tanker A, and Tanker A may sell it on the Gulf Coast or some other place, the value isn't established till after it's sold. And Tanker B comes in, and they go to a different port, so there's a different value for the oil. In addition to gravity differences, there's also a difference in where the market was. If we had less production and more infrastructure and did our own refining and sold it at arm's length immediately, these issues wouldn't be so big. But because we have a lot of production, we don't have in-state refining to handle it all. It's not a quick arm's length transaction. You get into this real Donnybrook about what is the real value of that barrel of oil in that tanker going this direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments or questions? If not, we'll go to our second presenter, Mr. Bernie Smith of Tesoro. Please identify yourself, sir, for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bernie Smith. I'm with the Tesoro Alaska Petroleum Company. I appreciate your bill and the opportunity to make a few comments. My comments will be very brief. Tesoro also agrees with the testimony that you have heard from AOGA. but we would like to probably bring another twist to that. As you know, the taxpayer should be entitled to an independent and impartial review of any tax dispute. In Alaska, this does not always happen for disputes arising from any tax administered by the Department of Revenue or any ad valorem tax. Our concern is more the desire to have is more than just the desire to have a tax court. We want an even and fair playing field in Alaska tax matters. House Bill 345 is also concerned with some of the same issues.
Excuse me.
I mean 341, excuse me. The current system infringes on the taxpayers' due process rights by requiring them to present their case to the Board of Equalization. This is in the ad valorem case. The board in some communities is also known as also the board, the borough assembly. As you know, the assembly also hires or at least approves the tax assessor. Think about the board's dilemma should they lower the taxpayer's assessed value, and reduce the amount of money available to pay the borough's services, or should they support the values proposed by their employee, the assessor? Taxpayers are required to make the legal record at the Board of Equalization hearings. The problem is that the board is a political body required by law to decide what evidence is allowed into record. The board also has arbitration rules that may affect the trial record. For example, in the Kenai board allows a taxpayer 30 minutes to present their case. This kind of time restricts the effects of the taxpayer's due process rights. Taxpayers must have enough time to present their case. In Tesoro's recent borough hearings or board hearings, the assembly allowed Tesoro 1 hour to present our case. We've asked for an additional 30 minutes, but the president of the assembly denied our request. In the end, we needed another 30 minutes to complete our case. This part of our limited appeals before the Supreme Court. Also, in our case, the board allowed an expert witness to testify via telephone on excess value of Tesoro's refinery. This expert has never been to Alaska or had seen Tesoro's refinery. As a trial court, the board should not have allowed this so-called expert to testify, and a professional tax court would have not allowed this to happen. Taxpayers should be provided with an impartial review of the ad valorem tax disputes, and that's what we'd like to add. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Do you have a copy of the testimony that we might have for the record?
I can get that for you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Smith? Any questions from the teleconference? Seeing or hearing none, the next speaker we have, excuse me, is Deborah Voigt from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Deborah Vogt, and I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. We certainly appreciate the opportunity to join the committee this morning and address the issue of the Department of Revenue's dispute resolution system. Obviously, it's an issue of great importance to us, and it's not a subject that is new to the department. The assertions that the system, as Mr. Mahoney called it, are flawed. Are certainly assertions that have been made over the years and are not new to this administration or even the two or three that preceded it. We recognize that there may be reasons to change the system that we currently use, and certainly one of the largest reasons is the taxpayer's perception. There is a perception that the dispute resolution process is unfairly biased against the taxpayer, and that perception's not going to go away. It hardly matters what the state might do within the current system. there's going to be the perception that the system is unfair to the taxpayers. The other reason that we might think about wanting to change the system is that it's difficult for the department. There's, I think, a binder about an inch and a half thick of memos and documents and so on dealing with prior commissioners' attempts to resolve for themselves, he or she, the issue of at what point does a commissioner need to step back from a proceeding so that he or she can be the final deciding officer in a dispute as it wends its way through the process that Mr. Mahoney outlined, which that outline of the process is essentially correct. And so this is something that we've struggled with, and certainly don't believe that anything we do without structurally changing the system is going to change the perception that the system is unfair. And for this reason, the current administration is committed to exploring alternatives for changing the system. Early in this administration, we had our staff contact every single other state in the United States and talk to them about their dispute resolution systems. And I will say that we are in the distinct minority among states in the way our system works. We're not alone. There are several other states that use the exact same process that we do, and that it is a process that has been upheld over and over by the courts. It is a process used by many federal agencies and every court that, to my knowledge, every court that ever has addressed the issue of is it appropriate for the same agency to be reviewing the facts and deciding the case has upheld the decision, has upheld the process as fair, as the Alaska courts have the Department of Revenue's process. But it is the minority of among the states, and the trend is away from the model that we use. The next thing that the department did was, through the Department of Law, contract with an expert in the field, a man named Paul Frankel, who is an attorney with the firm of Morris and Forrester, and he has consulted with, I think he said, more than 20 states on their tax resolution procedures and has given advice to those states. So we asked him to review our system, our laws and regulations, and even a set of proposed regulations that we had floating around left over from the prior administration, and ask him for his advice. His advice largely boils down to three recommendations. According to Mr. Frankel, a system should be independent. And a taxpayer should be able to make a record, that is, have its factual determinations made in an evidentiary hearing before it is required to pay the tax. And the judge or the judges in the system should be tax professionals. Now, the department's current system meets two of those criteria. We do hold the hearing before the taxpayer is required to pay, and we are tax professionals in the tax department. But the system is not, either is not or does not appear to be independent. That's certainly true. I would add a fourth criteria, given the peculiar nature of Alaska's tax structure. That is, that we have a small number of very large taxpayers in disputes that, as Mr. Mahoney testified, have in the past gone on for many years. And that is that I would look for a system that streamlines the process so long as it protects the fairness. But it seems to me that early resolution is better for everybody than late resolution. The department, after reviewing this study of the states and Mr. Frankel's advice, has decided to go forward with recommendations and request legislation. And we have requested permission from the governor to submit a bill this session that would address the department's dispute resolution system. We have not determined all the particulars of the approach that we'd like to take, but probably the approach will be to move the hearing function outside the Department of Revenue, but leave it within the executive branch of government. That is, not have it not be a tax court, but rather a hearing system similar to what we have, except divorced from the department and not reviewed by the commissioner, not subject to the commissioner's approval. I guess I'd like to interject in my prepared remarks for a moment to talk about some of the issues that have been raised before you, and I think may come up with some of the testimony from some of the other taxpayers, and that is the impression that you folks have that our system is, well, full of problems beyond just the issue that the hearing officers report to the commissioner who is responsible for administering the tax laws. That the cases are huge and take forever and so on. And I want to clarify a little bit that we really have made dramatic progress, and I don't think that the Knowles administration can take a lot of credit for it. It's John Pilkington and folks like him who have brought the system nearly current. We are now at a point, with the exception of the one case which has publicly been discussed, that is now pending before an outside hearing officer. It's not pending before the department. We moved it out of the department. That's the last big case that goes back to the early years. And as you discussed a little bit, it's those early years that really gave rise to the huge, huge disputes, the very wide gulf in positions between the taxpayers and the state, for many reasons that I'm sure we could go into at greater length if you'd like to hear it. But one of the main reasons is that nobody knew what the market value was. The market was opaque. Deals were done amongst the oil companies privately. There was no published price for Alaska North Slope for ANS crude. It wasn't traded freely on the open market, and it was hard to figure out what the true value was. And those are back in the days of $35 barrel oil. It made it, it's very different from where we are now. And so the disputes in the department was new at it. I mean, we bang overnight started producing massive amounts of oil, and it took the department really a long, long time. It's a very long learning curve to get those initial huge cases resolved. And we are now to the point, both in the severance tax and the corporate income tax, with the oil industry, that we are very close to current. We have audit cycles of 2 or 3 years at a time, and I don't think we're asking for the extensions in the statute. I mean, if we audit in a block of three, the three-year statute is almost gone by the time you start to audit, and so you do need to request extensions. But we're not requesting, 10, 12 years extensions in the statute anymore. And so I think that I say this in defense of the department, but I also say this because it makes it kind of a perfect opportunity to think fresh about how we're going to handle the whole thing. And I think it's a good time to think about moving the hearing function out from the department. I didn't prepare particular remarks about House Bill 341, but I think largely I would be reminded of the old saying, be careful what you ask for, you might get it. In my view, a tax court that follows along after the unchanged procedures of the department is not going to be consistent with my idea of streamlining the process. You will have a full evidentiary hearing before the formal hearing officer in the Department of Revenue, and then you'll have a full evidentiary hearing before the tax court in the judicial system. And it doesn't seem to me that it speeds up the process. Having the system, the taxpayers may pretty much hold back on the formal hearing and go through a kind of pro forma formal hearing just to get that over with and get into court, and where they'll have their real evidentiary dispute. But the law does say, and I'm glad to see that it does, that you can't present facts to the tax court that you haven't presented to the department. And so taxpayer is going to have to make its case in front of the department. And I think that's a very important provision, because it's important that the tax auditors have a chance to look at all the facts. You have to remember, all the facts really are in the hands of the taxpayer. The state tries to understand what the laws are, but how those laws apply to that taxpayer, it depends on information that's in the taxpayer's hands, not in the state's hands. And so it is important that the state have a chance, that the department have a chance to look at any factual assertions made by the taxpayer. So it seems to me the taxpayer is simply going to have to make his own case in front of the formal hearing in the department, and then go to the tax court and start all over again. And I just can't see how that's going to streamline anything or get us down the line toward early resolution. There are a number of other particular elements to 341 that are disturbing. One of them, for example, is the fact that a judge can be preempted. If, from what I know about the volume of work that there is, there probably wouldn't be more than one judge. And if that judge can be preempted without cause, without showing bias or actual reason to disqualify, after two or three decisions, the judge is going to be perceived as either a taxpayer's judge or a state judge, and one side or the other is going to bump them in every case, which means that all the cases are going to go to different judges, and we're not going to have tax professionals working on the cases. Another, I think, one of the more problematic parts of the legislation is the qualifications of the tax judge. It would have to be a person who is an Alaskan, who has been practicing tax law for 4 years, and who has not worked for the state, the Department of Revenue, or the Department of Law. Well, that means it's a taxpayer attorney, because that's who there is that practices tax law in the state that doesn't work for the department or the Department of Law. I guess the one other, I don't have a lot of other particular questions, I mean comments about the legislation. I think it's not a good idea to create a judicial system to resolve the problem. I think there are better ways to come at it, and I hope that with the cooperation of the Department of Law and the Governor's Office and so on, we'll come up with one, and we'd be happy to work with you over this coming session. I'd also just like to mention that the Department has been working on, at least in the severance tax area, on new regulations that I hope will narrow even further the gulf between the taxpayer's idea of what might be an appropriate interpretation of the statute and the department's idea. I think that's really the best thing to do in the long run, and there was some mention of this earlier, is clarify the laws so that in a self-assessing tax system, the taxpayers simply know what their obligation is and can pay up, and there isn't any dispute. I think we've come a long ways toward that with regulations that were adopted last year, in at least on the value issue. There still are a lot of issues relating to the transportation that can can cause a lot of disputes, but I think we all understand that that's where we need to go, and we may need to come to you and ask you for help in some of the clarification of the tax laws. That's all I had prepared to say. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Well, thank you very much, Deborah. I wondered, in you mentioning that you're in the process now of moving the hearings outside of DOR, but not necessarily to a court, staying within the administration. If that's moved, would that be de novo, or would that be carrying on as you do now with whatever has transpired, and the analysis there would go to this other outside review?
I hesitate to put too much detail to an idea that's just being fleshed out at the moment, but certainly the idea would be to have the evidentiary hearing, the fact-finding hearing, the de novo proceeding outside the department. Certainly we still have that issue of the auditors really ought to be able to look at all the facts that the taxpayers say exist in order to make their determination. And we aren't really talking about the red light, green light situation. We're talking about what is the proper way to apply the law to the taxpayer's facts. And if the taxpayer doesn't show his or her facts to the department, it's hard for us to make that determination. And so we need to wrestle with that, how to make sure the auditors get to see everything. But in terms of making an evidentiary record, yes, we believe that would go outside the department to hearing officers, not under the commissioner's direction. In terms of who to believe, in terms of which expert witness to give credibility to, those sorts of determinations, we agree that could be made by an outside hearing officer.
I'm going to apologize for this next statement in advance, but you mentioned in the early days that the market was opaque, and I suppose it was also opaque, but I'm not going to. Anyway, this bill, unfortunately,
would have been easier if it was.
Yeah, right. Was, as asked by Representative Ogun, and certainly I think your testimony was good, that this bill does not actually speed up the process. In fact, it may impede it because of the de novo aspect, that you start over from scratch. And I guess where I'm going to come from, at least since I've been in the legislature, I think law should be based on an objective, and that the regulations should be the fleshing out and the implementation of it. And so the speed-up process, I would hope that could be maintained within DOR or the regs that would establish that, to say this is the way we can speed the process up for the benefit, as you point out, to the state as well as to the taxpayer. But I think what this is hoping to address is to try and make as fair an understanding of a problem. It's a long call from when I was a rookie engineer, when you went out to a 250-barrel stock tank, and the only concern you had was the gravity and whether the guy dropped the line a little too deep or held it off bottom or something. Man, he went to a pipeline, and that was the end of it. And it was a published price for that particular mm-hmm. field, and nobody had a question with it. Now, mm-hmm. you got a lot of oil, and it's scattered all over the world, and so it is a major, major complex issue. And so what we're trying to do here, or through your department, or through something else that'll come in from somewhere else, is to try and make as few disputes as possible. But once the dispute has been made, and we may never get away from it because of the way we are, remote, large producer, we may never be able to get away from it completely, but we want to just try and make it as fair and painless as possible. That's the whole issue.
Well, if I might, Representative, I think that you're absolutely right. There are two aspects to streamlining. One of them is regulations that clarify the law, which we are in the process of working on with the taxpayers. And the other that I think of in the context of dispute resolution is how the disputes themselves are resolved. And you're absolutely right. We are never going to get away from all the disputes. There's too much money involved. I mean, we have disputes with fishermen over a few $100s. We're going to have disputes with the oil industry over a few $1 million. And the question is how, what kind of procedure is both fair and efficient for getting those disputes resolved. And I think the department has, in the past few years, been moving toward having its formal hearings look more and more and more like trial court proceedings in the sense of adopting the civil rules for a particular case, having the hearing officer just adopt the civil rules, which means all the discovery rules are the same and so on. And I'm not sure that's the best thing to do. I'm not sure that that, you know, 2 years of exchanging documents and having a fleet of paralegals come through the commissioner's office again and Xerox every piece of paper in the commissioner's office for every case, I'm not sure that really helps move things along. And so we're looking hard and at the nature of the proceedings themselves. And I would hate to see the system go off to court where it has to be the judicial system. It has to be the way the courts are used to resolving disputes, which may not be appropriate in a tax proceeding.
Well, I certainly understand your comments, and I think you bring up two very, very valid, if not problems, certainly valid concerns in the preemption problem with a single judge and the qualifications to meet this guy that can leap tall buildings and do all these things. And I really appreciate your openness, and I hope you appreciate the fact that we are not pointing the finger at any individual. We're just trying to work the process. I really do appreciate it. When do you think the bill might come to the legislature?
This session. Absolutely. Yeah.
Early enough that it would probably be acted on?
I hope so, yeah. I would hope it will be together with the governor's other package of legislation at the outset. You know how those things go. It may take us a little longer to nail things down than we hope, but we're working on it right now.
The reason I mention that, this is a sine die year, and
right,
so we'll be pushing this until we see something better. Mm-hmm. And so it would be, I think, remiss if we don't get it till March or April when there's no chance to pass it.
Absolutely. Understood. And I appreciate your openness in asking to hear from us today. And I guess I think there is a problem. If it ain't broke, it's perceived to be broke, and we can deal with the perception.
Yes, excuse me. Are there any comments from the audience or from the teleconference? Representative Ogden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deborah, I've already asked a lot of questions that might seem obvious to some people, but I think one of the good parts about having freshmen is that maybe we have a fresh perspective. So if it seems rather simplistic, bear with me. Why can't the rate, one of the problems has been identified that these tankers go to all these different locations and different markets and have different prices, and it's very confusing, and there's a lot of ambiguity about how much was actually charged. Why, is there any reason why there can't be more of a simplistic way to figure this out by using some sort of established price index for the day or the week? Or I mean, surely that's published, and you could maybe average it over the whole the market and say, okay, for this day, this is the tax rate, and this is what everybody owes. And, you know, might be more in some, less in others, but it'll average out. Is that too simple? Or?
Well, we've come in. John, correct me if I'm wrong here. This is John Pilkington, who's the director of the Department's Oil and Gas Audit Division. We've come a ways toward doing what you're talking about, in that we now, under our regulations, use published prices for the various markets, for a West Coast price, a Gulf Coast price, and a Mid-Continent price. Is that right? And so that has... as you may or may not know, a lot of the oil isn't ever really sold. It goes to the taxpayer's own refineries and is refined by the taxpayer. And so there is not an arm's length trade for a fair number of the barrels. But so you've got those prices in those different markets, but you still have the problem of one taxpayer has, for this particular month, more efficient tankers than the other, and his tanker fleet is older or newer, or his transportation charges are different to get to that market. And of course, we're looking for a North Slope price, and you have to net it back. And so that chunk of it, the transportation costs, is still open to large controversies. The legislature could probably develop some way to instruct us to levy a tax at Valdez based on some sort of a amalgam of the various destinations that might or might not hold true over time. I mean, what if you begin to export oil, and what if the mix of West Coast, Gulf Coast changes, and so on? I mean, there certainly the simplest thing to do would be to go to a cents per barrel or a dollars per barrel. Just every barrel that you take out, you pay us so many dollars. That's simple, but it's not very sensitive to price fluctuations in the market, and might or might not be perceived as fair or onerous, depending on how the market was doing by comparison. So there are certainly things that can be done. We are trying to do what we can by regulation, and it may be that at some point we may come ask the legislature for some help in clarifying the laws to make it simpler. But I think we are getting to the point where we're not going to see any more $500 million cases. It just isn't going to be another one. The disputes are over much narrower controversies than they used to be.
Thank you very much. Representative Cox?
Thank you, Chairman Green. Deborah, the recommendations of the independent analysis that you received, one of them was that you should have an independent entity that weighs the facts and makes a determination. And seemingly the administration is heading down a course that would keep that entity within reach of the administration. Do you perceive that to be a problem with the independent applicability of that idea? Can you solely have an independent entity and still be within the administration, I guess is the question.
Through the chair, Representative Cott, I think you'd probably have to ask the taxpayers how they felt about it, but it would seem to me that that a system, a hearing officer, for example, in the Department of Administration, who is not hired by the Commissioner of Revenue, is not subject to being fired by the Commissioner of Revenue, who is subject only to perhaps being fired by the governor. I have to say, I think that's about as independent as you could be. Certainly, the court system is still the state. I mean, their salaries are still paid by oil money, just like yours and mine. And so, I don't know. You know, maybe we should have Nevada decide all our tax disputes. But I think it's fair. I do. I think it would be. I have to say, I'm not sure. I think the present system is unfair, and that's why I think you have to ask the taxpayers. But I think it would be perceived to be independent from the Department of Revenue.
And
yes.
A follow-up then. In the dialogue that's taken place within the administration on reaching some course of action here as regard to creating an independent entity, has there been any discussion along those lines dealing with establishing a board or commission similar to what they have in workers' compensation, let's say?
The chair, we We're certainly open to entertaining any idea. From my experience, and probably the representatives don't know, I served as the head hearing officer during the Cooper administration, so I've been kind of familiar with revenue disputes resolution system from three perspectives, as an assistant attorney general, as a hearing officer, and now from the administrative perspective. And I can tell you there just aren't enough cases to be talking about having a board and a panel of judges and so on. I think one hearing officer is going to be pressed to be working full-time and probably had ought to be available to hear some other kinds of things from time to time. The problem with the big cases is, of course, it's feast or famine. Either there's a case that's going to take a hearing that's going to be every day, all day for 6 months, or you go, you know, for a long time and all the cases are being settled, which is certainly what has happened over the last few years, is that the settlement has been the way the disputes have been resolved. So I'm certainly would be reluctant to think about establishing a board and setting up. I just think it's too many people.
On that point,
yes. Representative Ogden? Oh, you have a follow-up. I'm sorry.
No, I'll pass.
Representative Ogden?
I've been of the opinion, having served on a board that had quasi-judicial powers, that possibly we should set up a system for not only, say, this type of dispute resolution, but get all the quasi-judicial powers away from the boards that make the regulations and then enforce them and have their own hearing officers and then enforce them and find people and yards. I think it's a basic problem of lack of separation of powers, and possibly maybe just put out on the table just for discussion, you know, some sort of separate entity that resolves disputes not only from Department of Revenue, but say Department of Commerce and different, and get them underneath the same conflict of interest, in my opinion.
To the chair, I can see a lot of merit in that kind of an approach. The difficulty I see from my perspective is that, as Mr. Frankel recommends, tax cases, in my view, ought to be decided by tax professionals. In other words, there ought to be people who develop a real understanding of the intricacies. It really would make me nervous, and I think, in fact, make the taxpayers nervous to think that you're going to take your case in front of someone that you have to start very from scratch in educating about how oil moves and where it goes and so on. I just think it needs to be a tax professional.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I guess on that point, it must make them nervous to take it before the legislators, you know, because we're not tax professionals, and yet we're going to decide tax, you know, how the tax professionals are going to do it. I mean, that's just, you know, one of the risks you take of having a citizen legislature, and maybe having citizens involved in, you know, late.
Oh, indeed, it makes us all nervous.
In fear of perhaps dwelling too long, I would like to follow up on a couple of things that Representative Cott said, that it would still be in the administration, but you indicated earlier it would be de novo, and I'm wondering if it truly is de novo and not just a kind of a rehash of what has already been transpired, would that save any time that the de novo hearing in a tax court? And I would presume the bill would address that. And the other thing, his suggestion of a board, I certainly share your concern that it would be people perhaps who are not tax experts. But I'm thinking of the Oil and Gas Royalty Advisory Board, that was set up to help the state determine what they should do with their one-eighth of Prudhoe. And there again, perception will vary with the eye of the beholder, but at least the state thought that it was a large enough issue that there should be some, if not authority, at least advice given the commissioner to help him make that very difficult decision. And now we're changing actually to tax dollars. And so I'm wondering if, again, in your presentation of the bill that will come out of your department, that those kinds of issues would be addressed.
Mr. Chairman, the first point you made about whether a system we might propose would actually streamline anything as opposed to a tax court, what we would be envisioning is moving the formal hearing function from the department to outside the department, and we would probably have to make the informal conference mandatory instead of optional. So that we did have a chance to sit down with the taxpayer and go over whether, just meet face-to-face and talk about whether there are any mistakes and so on. And then what now happens within the department would happen someplace else, would happen outside. The formal hearing procedure would happen outside. And then it would go on appeal to the Superior Court, just like it does now. And I might